Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you define Jewish food? There are those special dishes and ingredients used to celebrate religious holidays and the ubiquitous comfort foods like bagels and knishes and matzah ball soup relished by Jews and Gentiles alike. But limiting one's understanding of Jewish food to those few things leaves out quite literally a world of amazing flavors created or adapted by Jews in every corner of the globe, from Moroccan tagines to Indian curries to Mexican chocolate and fish tacos. Chef Tina Wasserman has gathered dozens of these recipes and the stories behind them in a new book called Entree to Judaism, a culinary exploration of the Jewish diaspora. Tina, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
You've been teaching cooking for years, and you write, sometimes Jewish, always kosher. But then you had this sort of epiphany about your own food heritage. Can you talk about that?
Well, it was actually, part of it occurred here in Dallas. I was teaching a class to my own sisterhood about 10 years ago. And I was pulling foods from the market that were representative of industry that Jews had been involved in. You know, so there were olives on the table, oranges on the table. And I got finished with the class, and the people said to me, why didn't they ever teach us this? And I said, probably because there was an awful lot more they had to teach you in the small amount of time they had in Hebrew school. But the bottom line was, it struck me that people didn't, you know, I was curious. This was my background. This is my love. This is why I went into the foods industry. But maybe I could explore it some more. And then about 7 years ago, the president of the Reform Movement, the Rabbi Yaffe, wrote an editorial about the perfunctory kiss. And he was talking about how, you know, after 30 years of marriage, a husband could kiss his wife hello or goodbye. And it said much more than just that little kiss. And, of course, he was referring to the fact that people shouldn't just be in synagogue twice a year, something like that. That was his motivation. But I wrote him a letter, and I said, you are missing the boat if you do not have a food column in your Reform Judaism magazine. I said, the olfactory sense is the one sense that is so brings back memory. And we need to, I said, I do not think that food will take the place of what can be taught in a religious atmosphere, but we cannot disconnect people from their heritage. And as we are a modern world, and certainly ingredients are relatively available all over, it's easy to disconnect from the stories behind it. So they said they didn't really have room for a column. I could write one article, and that was 7 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since. And my students, my readers, would constantly write me and say, you triggered a memory, you know, or can you help me with this? And I actually tell a story when I'm talking about how it triggered a memory with somebody. And it's...
So is it like Proust and the Madeleines, or?
It actually is a little more poignant. I was cooking for Rosh Hashanah, and I have about 110 people at my house, and
good
I
Lord.
Do all the cooking. Yeah, I know. It's not sit-down dinner. Don't anybody get excited. But I love to do it. And, you know, and I make about 20, 30 dishes just to explore the different foods. And I was exhausted. It was 10:30 at night. And as I tell people, what does a modern woman do? She takes a break and reads her emails. You know, so I went into my office, and I sat down, and I received an email, and she said, dear Tina, I was wondering if you could help me. Every year when I was growing up in Vienna, my mother used to make poppy seed strudel for Rosh Hashanah. She says, and I haven't had it since I was put on the Kinder transport when I was 7. Mm-hmm. Well, it just stopped me dead in my tracks. My eyes welled up with tears. I went to a Viennese cookbook that I had, because there was no way I was going to tell her to open up a can of solo poppy seed filling, which we all tend to do, you know. But, and I didn't really think that she wanted to make strudel, because by her age, I assumed that she was in her 70s at that point. But I wrote her back and I said, that do not apologize for bothering me. It is my pleasure and my honor to help you. And then I proceeded to talk to her a little bit about creating that recipe. And that's what I love to do. That's to create, to help recreate the memories and to help give the connection. And that's really why I wrote the book.
Well, and there is this extraordinary reverence for food in Jewish culture that goes far beyond foods that are used in religious observances
yes.
or particular holidays. What do you think accounts for that?
Well, very recently there was a Torah portion that talked about Abraham coming from his tent and preparing food and sitting outside of his tent to in case any of wayfarers were coming and needed some food. And I really think that that has a lot to do with it. There was this always being prepared in case somebody came to visit, certainly in the Middle Eastern culture, and the Ottoman Empire, and in Syria especially, in Iraq, there were always prepared for guests. As a matter of fact, for instance, on the cover of the book, there is that beautiful picture of an orange. Fruit was always served for dessert. But when I was talking to a Turkish friend of mine, she said, oh, yeah, but the sweets that you know about, they were always on hand in case there were guests or they were served for snacks. So it was people were always ready. And then, of course, it probably transformed over the years through living through poverty and then maybe succeeding to make sure that you always had enough. You know, my mother always said, make sure that you always have enough. You know, sometimes people surprise you and you can have enough, but they're still eating. But you do your best. You do your best.
I was really interested to read the essay you have in here about Jews and the orange trade because, mm-hmm. First of all, they weren't always the sort of sweet fruits that we think of today. Can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. The Romans were intrigued with oranges when they were on their vast campaigns and the oranges were bitter oranges, but they needed anything, you know, in the days when you didn't have preservation other than by using salt or a lot, you needed spices, you needed extra ingredients to make the foods taste better. And the orange was an intriguing new flavor. You know, like we all fall into that category. If something new is in the supermarket and it's a different flavor, you get intrigued by it and say, well, where can I use it? Well, one of the things that they did was they planted orange trees all along the perimeter of the Mediterranean. However, they didn't know how to cultivate it. They didn't take care of it very well, and the oranges didn't do very well. But when the Moors conquered many parts of the Mediterranean and certainly Spain, they were the ones that were – the Arabs had the wonderful culture and understanding about agriculture and water and irrigation and everything. And the groves flourished. And the Jews and the Arabs worked side by side. That was often the Jewish – occupation, you know, certainly at a time when there were times when they were not allowed to own land, they were still cultivating the land or when they weren't in the trades. Well, there is a holiday in the fall called Sukkot, where you're supposed to have a citron, which is called an etrog, and branches of different varying trees. And that's the simplified, obviously, interpretation for the holiday. But one of the things it says in the Torah is that the citron must be totally unblemished. Well, picture a fruit that's about 5 inches long, and it's a very thick-looking lemon, but it's not a lemon.
It looks like a big lemon.
It looks like a giant lemon, yes. Actually, it has no juice on the inside, and that's why it's cultivated for its peel. You get the candied citron, mm-hmm. especially coming up now with all the holiday fruitcakes. You know, that's what it's used for to this day. But for the Jews, they were required to have it be perfect. So that mean that the little stem end needed to be in the top of the etrog, and it could not be blemished. Well, in those days, there was no FedEx. So what did they have to do? The merchants literally had to come from North and East and Southern Europe down to Cyprus and Sicily and regions where they were growing the citron. And by the way, citron was so associated with Jews that even Roman coins and some old Roman synagogues had the citron as an emblem of the Jews. So they would come down, and when they come down, you know, it's sort of like going into Central Market nowadays or Whole Foods, and you go, oh, I came in for an eggplant, but what's this? You know?
It's a beautiful thing.
Then, this looks pretty cool, but, you know, it's horny, you know, like those horned fruits, you know, in the section. And you go, well, will it taste good? What would you do? And so they would say to the merchants, those are lemons. those are oranges. Why don't you take them back? See if your people like them. And they did. And that is really how the spread of oranges went throughout Europe. And to the early 1900s, the orange traders, even in Northern Europe and in England especially, who had the push carts, were Jews. The last push cart in England was owned by an orange push cart was owned by a Jewish person. And so that's how it spread. And I think people need to really understand that that's how all food cultures spread. I mean, think about us in the United States now. You know, when there was a big migration of Cantonese Chinese people into the United States for whatever occupation and for whatever reason, you know, the interest in Chinese food became much more prevalent and we were exposed to it more, you know, but the food that you were exposed to then might be totally different from the Asian cuisine you're used to now. You know, it changes and it migrates and it adapts.
Tina Wasserman is my guest. Her new book is called Entree to Judaism, A Culinary Exploration of the Jewish Diaspora. There were also Jews in India, throughout India.
Yes.
And there's some remarkable foods that I have to tell you I've never associated with Judaism before.
Well, I think that it's because you've got regional foods that they adapted to their homes. And I think it's very important to understand what Jewish food is. Jewish food only because of two things. It is food that is adapted from any region of the world that will conform to the laws of the Sabbath and the laws of keeping kosher. And so it's not the emphasis, for instance, in my book, is not on whether or not a recipe is kosher or not. It's an interest in, yes, this is India, and here are all these recipes that Indian Jews made when they lived there. You know, and so, yes, this is just as Jewish to them for the holidays as we might consider, you know, as you said earlier, matzo ball soup is to us. And so it's the most prevalent ingredient you will find in Indian cooking is the use of coconut milk, which, frankly, is a wonderful, wonderful flavor ingredient. And the reason it is that although it's called milk, coconut milk is pure vegetable. Mm-hmm. So it allowed a component to be added that would be very similar to cream. But in a hot climate like that, it was also better to use something like that than cream.
Well, it is interesting, too, that throughout history, people have been looking for not ways around the laws of kosher, but things that would give a similar flavoring, you know, even then in India, as you mentioned, the milk.
Yes. And,
you know.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But it was easy there because they were on the spice, you know, they were producers of many of
right.
the spices. There was a lot of fish that was used because they were in the coastal regions. Chicken was not readily available, but it was definitely used. And this is very interesting as I explored the different regions of the world, regardless of how wealthy or how poor the community was, and very often it was on the poor side, or how readily available it was, chicken was served for Friday night. That it was just amazing. But they use the same foods as everybody else. Certain cuisines are easier to adapt to a Jewish home. One of my specialties over the years in teaching was always Chinese food.
Let me have you pause there. We're going to take a break, and then we'll get some Chinese Jewish recipes in just a moment. Tina Wasserman is my guest. She's a chef whose new cookbook is called Entree to Judaism, A Culinary Exploration of the Jewish Diaspora. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Chef Tina Wasserman. Her new book is called Entree to Judaism, A Culinary Exploration of the Jewish Diaspora. She will have a book signing tomorrow at the Barnes & Noble at Preston and Royal in Dallas. That takes place from 2 to 6 p.m. There's another signing at Neiman Marcus on December 12th from 2 to 4. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And you tantalized us before the break by promising to tell us about some Chinese recipes.
Yes. When making Chinese food kosher, it is very, very easy. The only thing I needed to do was substitute veal instead of pork, because it had the same color and the same texture and similar flavor and took on the flavor. Now we're talking about pork, not if it was substituting for a smoked ham or whatever. I've been down the road with Thuringer summer sausage and stir fry. It doesn't work. I promise you, don't even bother. But the real trick in having the Chinese food in your home, whether or not you're kosher, whether or not you're using pork or veal, is how you add the foods to the wok at the time and the seasonings. And that I understood, and so that I could recreate in my own cooking school. And although most of my students were not Jewish and didn't care whether it was kosher or not, they were there for the flavor, and they got what they wanted, and it tastes just like the restaurants. So it's very easy to adapt that. They don't use cheese and they don't use milk products, so works.
It is. I was interested to read that in antiquity, a lot of Jews were in fact cheesemakers.
Yes, because they had access to the animals. They could make their own milk, and they tried to make everything for themselves, mainly because that way they could regulate whether or not it was a kosher product. It conformed to any of the minute, delicate laws that required of those foods. But and it was easy. If they had cheese, that was their protein, and it could be put aside, and so that they incorporated it into their foods. Because for those listeners who might not be familiar with what the laws of keeping kosher are, I'm going to give the simplistic version so that they can have a basic understanding. It's basically no shellfish, no pork, no fish that never had any scales to them, and no milk with meat. Now, it's very interesting because people always cite a passage in the Bible that says, "Thou shalt not seethe the calf in its mother's milk." And so it's been interpreted over the years, oh, well, we don't want to kill the calf with the mother watching because she might give up her milk, you know, and then it wouldn't be good, you know, or it would upset her too much. But the real truth in the laws of kashrut, the real basis, not truth.
That's where the word basis, kosher comes from.
Yes, kashrut is the Hebrew word for keeping kosher. Yes, I'm sorry. Good point. Is that it was a way of separating the Jew from the non-Jew in the Semitic lands, because they all certainly looked alike. And so that they would all be able to know who their brethren were, so to speak. And at the time, what little meat was cooked, which was often lamb, you know, and there was some beef, was cooked, seethed, or stewed in milk, because as we know in modern cooking technique, milk and enzymes in milk will tenderize, you know, tougher cuts of meat. So that was really the origin. It was from a cooking technique that we want to keep our cooking technique separate from theirs, so that you can identify when you're on the road who is a brethren that you can spend the Sabbath with, or who you know that you can break bread with, so to speak. And that really, it was a sense of community that really helped or kept the spread of the Jewish communities connected. And in the diaspora, we think of the diaspora as when the Jews were expelled into Babylon, you know, in the 6th century, you know, BCE. But the truth of the matter is it's all diaspora. It's all movement. You know, when I moved here many years ago. I've lived in Dallas for over 30 years, although I know I don't sound like I'm from Dallas. I do say y'all.
Nobody from Dallas really sounds like they're from Dallas anymore.
Yeah, right. Well, that's true. That's true. But when I came here, there was a specialty in bakeries around the Jewish New Year called Teglach. It was a dough in a honey syrup. And, you know, all the bakeries had to place your orders now. And I came down here, nobody knew Teglach, so I taught it. You know, and then a number of years later, I was invited to teach at the JCC in Manhattan, the Jewish Community Center of Manhattan, and they wanted me to teach Southwestern cuisine. Well, hello. You know, what do you expect? But the distance, and I try to remind people this, the distance between New York and Texas is about the distance between Spain and the Middle East. And it was the expulsion of the Jews in 1492, which really transformed the whole food culture throughout the Mediterranean and the world.
Expulsion from Spain.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There were 200,000 Jews in Spain at the time of the expulsion. There were 40,000 Jews on the island of Sicily. They all had to leave. As a matter of fact, Columbus sailed the last day that a Jew was allowed in Spain. And he had, we know his doctor and his guide, among others on his crew, were Jewish. And it's speculated that he might have been a second-generation converso Jew, Columbus himself. So everybody was out of there. But they had to go someplace. So many of them went to Portugal. But in 7 years later, they were expelled from Portugal. The Inquisition came to Portugal. So they went to South America, which is very important to remember in terms of trade routes later mm-hmm. on. They went to Amsterdam. Some of them went over the Pyrenees, you know, to Bayonne, which became the, by the way, in the future, the future pastry capital of France. And many of the Jews were involved in the pastry trade and the chocolate trade there. But then they went through the Mediterranean. Well, 40,000 Jews on the island of Sicily went into what we now know as mainland Italy. They brought with them the foods in the same way that I brought Teglach to Dallas and Southwestern cuisine to New York. They brought with them the foods that they had been exposed to by the Moors. The Moors had brought foods from all the spice route, So vegetables and spices and ingredients. So spinach came from Persia and eggplant came from India, along with the spices, just to name a few. But I mention eggplant because when the Jews came to Italy, nobody was eating eggplant. They thought it was poisonous. And they also thought it was Jew food. So for 100 years, nobody ate eggplant in Italy but the Jews.
That's hard to imagine.
I know. It's very hard to imagine. But the Italian word for eggplant is melanzana, and it comes from the words malanzana, which means bad spirit. All of Europe, it wasn't just Italy, all of Europe thought it was part of the nightshade family and it was too dangerous to eat. Whereas, interesting, in Spain it was called berenjena, and that meant love apple. They thought it was an aphrodisiac. Italians thought it was poisonous. Eventually they all figured out it was good. You know?
Well, you remind us here, and I hadn't been aware of this, that Italy is home to the longest lived, continuously inhabited Jewish community in all of Europe.
Right. As a matter of fact, the Italian Jews, you know, we tend to break up Jewish communities into two groups, the Sephardic Jews and the Ashkenazic Jews. And that comes from Ashkenaz was the Hebrew word for Germany, meaning that Eastern, that European part of the world. And Sephard was the Hebrew word for Spain, or the Iberian Peninsula. And so when people migrated, they automatically assumed that anybody who wasn't Ashkenazic, which is what most American Jews have ancestry in Ashkenazic countries, they automatically assumed that they must be Sephardic Jews, but they're not. They call themselves Italkim. And they have been there since probably, I would say, about 200 years after the destruction of the first temple when Jews escaped, or when they were taken as prisoners by the Romans and then they settled in Italy. And it was, there were certainly other waves of migration to Italy. But yes, there are. I met a woman. I was in Italy last fall and I met a woman whose can trace her ancestry back to before the what we call the Common Era.
That's amazing.
Yes, yes. It's fascinating. I mean, I can only trace my relatives back about four generations. Who knows? But I'm beginning to think that they might have been originally Sephardic because I'm from Romanian heritage, you know, and their culture is closer to Bulgarian, which is definitely Sephardic.
Tina Wasserman is my guest. Her new book is called Entree to Judaism, a culinary exploration of the Jewish diaspora. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Whitney in Archer City. Hello, Whitney.
Hi. I have a question as far as during your research, if you perhaps ran across written recipes. I mean, obviously the ancient world, not many people read and were not literate, but if there was maybe like a recipe that was so sacred it had to be made a certain way or something other than just, you know, evolution from mother to daughter sort of thing. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Actually, I think you really hit the nail on the head. The first Jewish cookbook that was ever written was actually in England in the 1800s. There are some recipes that were written down a little bit earlier than that, but there was nothing that was certainly compiled. The recipes that are sacred, and I think that sacred is an important word here because it's not referring to text, it's referring to family and heritage. They were really passed down from mother to daughter. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting when I field questions about foods. I try very hard not to give them a good recipe that might taste good to me and now. I try to tell them, use it as a springboard to recreate your memory. Hmm. And it's one has to remember that there is only one food that is prescribed in all of the Torah, and that is matzah. Everything else is referred to. Certainly, we refer, you know, the seven species, and you know, with almonds and figs and dates, but they're referred to that. There's the only prescribed food is matzah, and after that. And that was always home, you know.
Which is unleavened bread.
Unleavened, yes. It's unleavened bread. It's just flour and water that has to be made within from the time the first drop of water hits the flour, which has to be wheat that comes from a field that has been tilled and handled the way prescribed in the Bible. It's for 18 minutes from the time the water hits the flour to the time it's finished baking, because that way it's preserved as unleavened. But the truth of the matter is, we didn't have matzah meal. And, you know, women were chomping it and breaking it down by themselves, you know, prior to the production of Thank You, Manischewitz, because they were the first.
Makes it much easier to get that 18 minutes out of the way if someone else did it.
Well, if somebody else did that, and then you can be creative with the rest. So I'm sorry to say that one of the things that I did do is I did research old cookbooks, some very old cookbooks, and I found myself gleaning information from the Torah, and sometimes I'd even find myself reading Josephus. And Josephus was a historian from the first century who documented a lot about the lives of Jews in that region. And so I tried to get a feel for what was available there. But the truth of the matter is, if your grandmother is around, and maybe if you're lucky enough to have your great-grandmother around, ask questions now, because that's really important for carrying on those traditions. I hope that helps.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Fort Worth and speak to Jimmy Ann. Hi, Jimmy Ann.
Hello.
Hi.
What I find very fascinating, and I can't leave the radio, is your knowledge about not only the cooking part aspect, but where the food comes from and where it came and who brought it and that sort of thing. And you remind me a lot of Rick Bayless that I watch on KERA on Saturday. He takes you into the markets and explains that to you.
Uh-huh.
My question today is, I've never heard you mention the name organic. And I was just curious, is the Jewish community caught up in this organic fiasco that the rest of the world is trying to pursue?
That's a very timely question. The answer is yes and no. We have always been caught up with ethical aspects of food production, ethical aspects of, cattle and raising meat and certainly produce. If you go back, you can look in the Bible, and they talk about letting the fields lie fallow for 1 year after 6 years, every seventh year. And they're reading, I don't know if you read Omnivore's Dilemma, but if you've read that, you know, there was reason behind that. And it helped in the cultivation and the production of foods. I think that organic is something that is very, very new to all of us and yet very ancient. It was done without thinking about what would be the right way to produce foods. The head rabbi of the Reform Movement at a recent biennial in Toronto in November actually spent a great deal of time about Jews looking ethically at the food they're consuming and the amount of food they're consuming, you know. And I found that to be very interesting. I do not consider myself an expert on the organic movement, so I don't want to mislead you in any way. But the truth is, one of the things when I talked about even kosher meat, one of the reasons that a cow is kosher is it is humanely slaughtered. It is literally slaughtered by hand by a rabbi who is the knife has to be sharp enough to just get it without nicking the animal at all so that the animal dies peacefully.
Tina Wasserman is my guest. We're talking about her new book, Entree to Judaism, a culinary exploration of the Jewish diaspora. She's got a signing tomorrow at the Barnes & Noble at Preston & Royal in Dallas, another one on December 12th at Neiman Marcus. You can find more information about that at cookingandmore.com. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. If you want to be part of it, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Chef Tina Wasserman. Her new book is called Entree to Judaism, a culinary exploration of the Jewish diaspora. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. To Jimmy Ann's question in the last segment, I was surprised, or have been surprised in doing research, to find that a lot of Jews are really interested these days in vegetarian cooking. And you have a really interesting recipe for, I didn't think it was possible, vegetarian chopped liver.
Yes. Actually, that's a tradition that I think probably was started in the early 20th century. And it was a way for Jews to acclimate in their own, in America, mm-hmm. you know, to the cuisine and what was readily available. I put it in there because of its historical value, not for any definition of my culinary skills. Because if you look at the recipe, very often it starts off with lentils, but a lot of times it starts off with green beans and canned green beans, not frozen, people, not fresh, canned green beans and canned peas, you know, and walnuts and a lot of fried onion and egg. And so it mimics the flavor. And interesting that you should bring that up, because the reason I included that and the reason my first memory of it was that my uncle Barney's, he was my mother's uncle, so he was my great uncle Barney's 80th birthday. When I was a kid, I was intrigued by food from a very, very early age. And it just struck me that this was interesting and it was different. And so when I saw recipes as I got older, I explored them and experimented with them. And so there might be better ones out there, but this has mimicked my memory. And that's what I want people to do. I really want them to try to explore their memories. I would like to say one thing. In the book, there is a picture and the recipe for my grandmother's potato knishes. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a potato knish that the dough is made from potato and the filling is fried onion. And I love it because it was what she always served it when the family got together. But what's memorable about it is when she was getting older, she had a heart attack. I mean, everybody thought she was going to pass away. And she didn't. She recovered, thank God, and everything was great. But I remember, as a 14-year-old, the relative standing around her hospital bed talking about her knishes. And that probably was the first time it really struck me that people really connect themselves with their heritage, with their ancestry, through the food. And so it's, as a matter of fact, in the picture for the knish is a little teeny glass that the family used to use having a little schnapps, you know, when they first got together. And when she did pass away, I asked for that. So I always ask for something that's food related that means something to me.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Jonas in Dallas. Hey, Jonas.
Hi there. I just wanted to know, I'm half Sephardic, and one of the many books I've read on Judaism, one time I came across something that I couldn't believe. Is it true that Jews were the original innovators of pizza?
That I didn't come across in my investigation for this book. I do know that pizza really originated as a pizzoladiere in southern France. And it was more sautéed tomatoes and onions and put on top of a dough. Now, considering that there was in southern France, really meaning in the Provence region, and there was a large Jewish community there. As a matter of fact, there was a fairly thriving Jewish community there because even when life was getting very restricted throughout Europe for Jewish communities, the papal see, when it came to Avignon, made sure that they kept the Jewish people close by because they were their advisors and their explorers and, you know, and their traders on the seas. So it's possible that that's where that story came from. But like anything else, you have to remember that food can have its origins, but it gets changed over so that we think of it more as a cultural food from a region rather than from a particular people. When I was talking about eggplant, caponata, which is a very common and very popular Italian relish, eggplant relish, is actually a 500-year-old Sabbath dish. And the reason it's a Sabbath dish, aside from my story that I told you earlier about the Jews being the ones to eat eggplant, is that it had sugar and vinegar in it, which was a preservative. And so the rules of the Sabbath are you're not allowed to work on the Sabbath.
So you could make it ahead.
You could make it ahead. Mm-hmm. So either the very slow-cooked stews, the hamins from Middle East, the tagines from Morocco, and the cholents from Eastern Europe, or cold foods like the caponata or even gefilte fish are food that can be served cold, are foods that get their link to the religion rather than, you know, to necessarily to a region.
An email here from Lucas asks to make sure that you mention your rugelach recipe that is delicious.
I think I know who that Lucas is. This is very interesting, and this is where my background in foods and my college degrees have really helped me in transforming some of the recipes from memory to make them as good, if not better, for the modern kitchen. Rugelach is a basic dough. Well, basic dough of butter, equal parts butter, cream cheese, and then double the amount by volume of flour. You will find that recipe all over the place. Sometimes it's called Schnecken from the word snail because it was rolled up. And sometimes it's called Schnecken because it's also made with sour cream. But the basic cream cheese dough is a basic cream cheese dough. I used a modern, if you've got a KitchenAid mixer or a good quality of a stand mixer, I beat the living daylights out of the butter and the cream cheese first so that I incorporate air into it and I get it light and fluffy. Then when I add the flour, I literally turn, I mean, I know this is not good for the motor, but I kind of turn it on and off like I'm pulsing it, like in a processor. But I'm not using a processor, people. Because,
why not?
Because a processor works so rapidly, and the heat of the blade going around will actually subtly melt the butter. And what I'm trying to do here is create almost microscopic layers of fat and flour, very much the same way that you produce a croissant. You know, that's a yeast dough. But the reason you have those little air pockets is those air pockets in a croissant are where the butter was. So if I don't overwork the butter and melt it, and I don't get it to dissolve some of the flour, then I'm not really creating that same kind of dough. And so that's my first secret to the rugelach. And the second secret, Lucas, is that I roll it out and I roll all my pastry that isn't savory. I roll all my pastry in confectioner sugar. I never roll it on a floured board. There's 3% cornstarch in confectioner sugar. It's just enough to help prevent it from sticking. But very often with rugelach, you've got such a rich dough and you've got such a sweet filling, you don't get a balance. But by rolling it in confectioner sugar, you incorporate some of that sugar into the interior, and so it gives a balanced flavor. You know, we're at Christmas time. I always give the analogy, if you're listening to Handel's Messiah, you want to hear the whole entire chorus together. You don't want to hear the sopranos overpowering the altos, and you certainly don't want to hear the alto in the fifth seed overpowering her section. It's the same with food. You can have myriad flavors in a dish, but you need to have it balanced in order for any food to really taste terrific. So that's the answer to that's the secret. I can now retire, Lucas.
You also have a recipe in here for challah, which is something that I have actually my own food memories associated with. Uh-huh. It always seemed like it would be really complicated to get it right. Is that a difficult bread to make?
It really isn't, but you were asking me at a time where I'm finally enjoying my recipe back again, and I think that it had a lot to do with one of two things. I'm always looking at this scientifically. My degree was a Bachelor of Science in OMEC, but that's not the reason. I'm just trying to figure out what goes on in these foods. I think that when we had a drought for a couple of years, the mineral content in our water was different. And I was using I always use margarine. A lot of people use oil in their bread. I don't use butter because traditionally it's served on the Sabbath meal and I wouldn't have milk with meat.
Right.
But you certainly could. And anybody can adapt any of the recipes they want in my book. But I was using a margarine that I think when they went from trans fat, must have done something to their margarine. But now it's back the way I like it. It's not hard. It's very, very easy to make challah. The quote-unquote hard part is if you want to attempt to braid it. And that's really not that hard either. But those of you who have watched me do it or tried to do it might be rolling your eyes right now. But it really is. You learn how.
I'm guessing it tastes just as good whether or not you can attempt the braid.
But I'd like to tell a little story about that. When my husband's grandmother was 90 years old, she sat me down, and I was in my 20s. She sat me down at the kitchen table with six strings and taught me how to do the traditional six braid. And some bakeries do the six braid to this day, and some do a four braid, and some do a three, whatever. But in researching for the book, I noticed that there was a part in Leviticus that says specifically that every Sabbath, the 12 tribes of Israel were to bring their bread. And, of course, their showbread at that time was not a challah. It was probably more like a pita, but brought it to the altar. And they were required to put it in two rows of six. And I thought, you know, we're supposed to have two loaves of challah next to each other. And I asked a learned professor at the Hebrew Union College campus in Cincinnati, I said, do you think that possibly putting two rows of six braided challah, two six braided challahs next to each other is like having two six rows of six? And he said, it's very possible. And I think that that's a very important, you know, point to mention. Our traditions don't necessarily have a starting point in something religious. It might have just been that some religious housewife, and I'm saying housewife because in those days the woman did the cooking. Mm-hmm. No, and then the women did the cooking.
That's what I mean.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looked at the reading and said she would braid it in six, and so she would interpret it that way. And then people, it just followed tradition because somebody liked it. Very much in the same way that I suspect that a lot of people are going to start rolling out in confectioner's sugar now. You know, but it's when you hear something that you like, you carry it on. And I like those traditions. And we start new traditions and we have, you know, we try to recreate old ones.
We have about 2 minutes left. Are there certain things that you always make every year at Hanukkah?
At Hanukkah. Well, I always make white latkes, folks. They don't turn out gray. They don't turn out green. And I don't care whose recipe you use. If you do nothing else differently this year, then grate your potato and then put it in a colander and run water through it. It is the starch in the potato that causes your potatoes to darken. And if you don't drain that liquid, you have extra liquid and lots of starch, and that's what really makes your latkes, your potato pancakes, thin and gray.
And soggy.
And
right?
Soggy, yeah. Absolutely, and soggy. The other thing is I never peel my potatoes because I don't use russet potatoes. I use the California Long White or Yukon Gold.
With the tender skin.
The tender skin. Mm-hmm. Is might as well keep the nutrients in there. And the last, if I don't have to peel 8 or 12 potatoes, I'm a very happy camper. So that's what I always make, you know, definitely make that for Hanukkah. And I make the cheese latkes for Hanukkah now, too, as well, to recreate the story of Judith and her saving the Jews by getting rid of a general.
And you serve
you have
them,
to read the book to see that story.
You serve them with applesauce? Or
yes, homemade mm-hmm. applesauce. And that's the other thing. I cook my apples with the skin on them because the flavor cells are right underneath the skin, and it gives it a rosy glow. And I put one stick of cinnamon. I cover the bottom of the pan, regardless of how many apples you use. Cover it with about a half inch of water, quarter of an inch of water if it's a small pan. Put your apples in, steam it with one stick of cinnamon, and then if you have a food mill, you don't even have to try to remove the skin. And it'll be terrific, and you won't need sugar.
Sounds delicious. Tina Wasserman's new cookbook is called Entree to Judaism, a culinary exploration of the Jewish diaspora. She's got a signing tomorrow from 2 to 6 at the Barnes & Noble on Preston and Royal, one also at Neiman Marcus on December 12th from 2 to 4. Tina, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It has been my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.